please give me feedback if I'm cutting it off, because you were, I don't think I am, but
I don't know how
to today in the last session, I just wanted to handle several of the issues that have come up during the course of this from some of you, and provide probably a more lengthy discussion about those issues than we had before. So the first one, if you go to the first slide, it says discussion questions. One of the issues came up in regarding to the preference interview was that resident and continent interviews were embarrassing. Others heard that wasn't particularly productive, but I think embarrassing was the key. So that's either due to our form or, you know, perhaps you're nervous just about talking to people about incontinence. But that's what I want to address here. I think it's a mistake not to directly confront the issue with incontinence for somebody who has it, even if it is embarrassing to. I mean, one of the biggest problems in the community is that patients don't tell their physicians that they're incontinent. They go untreated for years. And the only way you can find out in many cases is to directly ask, and you have to have that conversation. Now, you can't have it in private, you can make it as humane as you possibly can, but just avoiding the conversation altogether is not very productive, even if somebody's embarrassed about it. I mean, I think you need to have a direct conversation about what kind of treatments they want or don't want. And however you ask that, it has to be asked. Furthermore, I mean, there's clear stuff in the regulatory guidelines about this. On this slide, we listed, you know, three of the sentences or paragraphs from the new MDS 3.0 RAI manual. More than this, but these three things that contain some direct statement of relevance to the issue of interviews. For instance, in the RAI, it says, in regard to the care plan, they want evidence that an individualized program was communicated to staff and the resident as appropriate verbally and through a care plan. Blue records and a written report. There's an emphasis on verbally. They want a notation of the resident's response to the coiling program and subsequent evaluations as needed. And then at a different place on page 8, if you have the new incontinence RAI outline in front of you, it says interview the resident if he or she is capable of reliably reporting his or her incontinence. Speak with family members or significant others if the resident is not able to report. The upshot is, you really are required to do this. I really think it's a good idea. Now, maybe the preference questions we gave you are not the best. Some of you had criticisms about it. What I would like to do with that is that if you'd like to talk to me personally about the preference interview that we gave you to use, let Annie know, and you and I can have a personal conversation, because I would like to improve it. But I don't think it's a very good option to not have a direct interview with the patient at all. If you don't, I think you're leaving yourself open to problems with the survey staff in terms of individualization issues, which is a theme that runs throughout all of the guidelines. And I still think it's a good idea professionally either. Now, the next question, this came up maybe within the last week or so. Does a resident have to say yes to a pump to be on profitability program? And I think the specific issue was that at home mentioned that they had a resident who, maybe more than one, who followed a routine. I mean, they would take them to the bathroom before breakfast, after breakfast, or maybe before and after every meal. And that maintained the resident really didn't say, but clear from the nursing home example whether the resident would say they kill or not. Maybe they wouldn't. But the question is that acceptable? Well, the answer is yes. Yeah, all along I said there are a few residents who are just nonverbal, but I think very few, who are responsive to just putting them on the toilet. And they aren't verbal no matter what. I think it's very few. In general, residents can be always brought to answer a question like, do you have to go to the bathroom? If you don't like that one, will you try to use the bathroom? Or if you don't like that one, it's time to use the bathroom. Is that okay? They can almost always be brought to answer a question like that with a yes or no or something. And doing that, engaging the residents that way, I think is good for the resident, number one. And two, again, completely consistent with all the guidelines in the RAI manual as to what you're supposed to do with the resident in terms of, quote, individualization or personalization. So my answer to the question is, you do what works. I mean, the major outcome is getting a resident dry in a full toilet. Without talking to them, that's what you should do. But I think you should be very careful about that, because I really think that you should be able to talk to them in a way that you can get a response and at least a set, you know, to actually try to close. In our experience, we have seen very, very few cases where residents will not say anything at all about the closing event and just go along with it. We've seen some, but very few. Almost always, if you have a conversation with them at the point of care, they will say something about it, and the whole process will be made easier. Now, the third thing that I wanted to discuss was just kind of been put on the back burner, but this is the whole issue of bowel incontinence. This series of training sessions were not related to bowel incontinence, but in the same section of the new MDS and the RAI manual, they do ask you to check a box, which is on the slide, MDS 3.0, new issue, bowel incontinence. They do ask you to check a box where it says, is a coding program currently being used to manage the resident's bowel incontinence? Yes or no?
I just want to mention that we're on slide 5.
Yes, we're on the slide, new issue, bowel incontinence, MDS 3.0. So the question is, how should you handle that? Well, let me give you a bit of history again, because we've done, you know, we're going to publish an article very soon about this very issue. If you'd like that article, let Annie know. It's coming out in the Journal of American Geriatric Society about bowel incontinence and prompted bleeding. Here's what we know, and when I'm done telling you what we know, then I'm going to tell you what my suggestion is that you do in relation to this care planning and this MDS item. Okay, first, we've known for quite a while that if you just do prompt avoiding only, like you're doing, you will, with just about the same patients who improve urinary incontinence, you will get an improvement in how often, how frequently those patients also have an appropriate fecal void in the toilet. They kind of go hand in hand. But the surprising thing has always been is that despite the fact that people who get very prominent urination, speaking, you know, with prompted voiding, even though they toilet much more frequently in the toilet, they still don't reduce the frequency of their fecal incontinence episodes that much. They don't decrease it as much as they decrease urinary incontinence frequency. So we did a second trial. This is what's going to be published. We did a second trial. We said, well, maybe it's more complex. But in addition to prompted voiding, to produce bowel incontinence, you have to worry about how hydrated somebody is, how much food they're eating, and mobility, exercise, because all that's related to constipation and bowel health. So we'll do a trial. We'll combine prompted voiding with moving people around on an exercise program every couple hours and increasing their food and fluid intake with the prompting protocol that we've developed, and then we'll see what happens. And before all this, we worked with some gastroenterologists who actually did some bowel exams, and that turned out to be the key. Because what happened in the second trial is pretty much the same thing. People improved their food and fluid intake. They moved more of their physical activity. About the same number, 50 or 60%, significantly improved their urinary incontinence. And those same people dramatically increased how often they had fecal voids in the toilet. But they still continue to have fecal incontinence about once a day. You didn't get the same reduction in fecal incontinence that you got in urinary incontinence. Why? Well, the best explanation is that on the bowel exam, most of these people, for reasons we don't understand, had a condition called dyssurgynia. What that means is that when they were trying to empty the bowels, they would increase abdominal pressure like you normally do to try to squeeze the fecal matter out. But at the same time, for whatever reason, they were tightening their sphincter muscles. In other words, they were working against themselves. They were increasing pressure to evacuate. At the same time, they were tightening their sphincter, which kept them from completely evacuating or emptying. Why they do that, we don't know. But that probably is the explanation of why they continued to have some degree of fecal incontinence, despite the fact that they were polluting a lot more, and drinking a lot more, and losing a lot more. Probably what was happening is that they were never completely empty. You know, if you try to expel stool and you tighten your sphincter, you're not going to completely empty. You're going to have some fecal matter in the lower rectal bowl that's probably going to leak in between times, and we think that's what's happening. Now, I guess that's interesting for you to know, but I guess your question really should be, well, what do we do? Here's what I would do. You have a three-day toileting trial, and during that three-day toileting trial, you can calculate how often somebody is urinary incontinent, as we tell you to do, but you can also see whether people have appropriate bowel movements. If they do have significant appropriate bowel movements during that three-day trial, I would care plan it and say that you're going to do prompted bleeding for bowel incontinence as well, and check yes for this form. If they don't increase the frequency of their bowel movements in the toilet, or don't decrease the frequency of their incontinent bowel movements very much, then I would handle that the same way I handle a patient who doesn't do well in prompted bleeding. I would say that the toileting program did not work. We talked to the patient about the fact that it did not work, and we decided to manage it with a check and change program. Or, if you wanted to, you could do a referral for that patient into a GI specialist who works with fecal incontinence. But that is easier said than done, in my experience, because even at Vanderbilt, there are not that many, or UCLA, there are not that many people who specialize in fecal incontinence, for some. Who would really know what to do with a referral from a nursing home patient who had a bowel incontinence. But anyway, I take your three-day trial and reporting how well somebody did with bowel incontinence on that three-day trial is what you should do right now, and that would cover you, and you'd be doing the best thing that you possibly could be doing with bowel incontinence, given what we know at this point. By doing that three-day trial, I think you'd cover yourself. Okay, the next slide. The question came up based on the RAI, that's based on the MDS 3.0, the new incontinence items, are early checks needed? And I think that question came up because of issues about patterns of incontinence and so on. So this has come up before, so let's talk about it more specifically. If you're looking at this slide, I'm talking about MDS 3.0 RAI manual now, three-day trialing trial or early checks needed. This is what the RAI says on page H4. It says, review the medical, listen to that, you know, what the county surveyor did. Review the medical record for evidence of the trial of an individualized resident-centered toileting program. A toileting trial should include observations of at least 3 days of toileting patterns with prompting the toilets and a recording results in a bladder record or a voiding diary. Toileting programs may have different names, habit training, scheduled voiding, bladder rehabilitation, bladder retraining. The same page below that, it says simply tracking incontinence status using a bladder record or a voiding diary should not be considered a trial as an individualized resident-centered toileting program. In short, what we we've told you to do, or what we've asked you to do, is perfectly, I mean, it's almost right on to the language that you're seeing on this page right here. It's exactly what we told you to do. Now, nowhere in this language does it say that hourly checks are necessary. And we told you to do 2-hour checks. So what does that mean? Well, given my experience, which has not been good with the surveying process, since it doesn't specify hourly or 2-hourly, that leaves it open, in my view, to the judgment of surveyors. And I can't say there won't be some surveyor who will interpret this as saying it has to be done every hour. And if you don't do it every hour, you'll have a problem. But I think that's not likely. I mean, I think a 2-hour program is listed in all the published literature about this. So it should be acceptable, but in the absence of more specificity, who knows what a surveyor will do. But I do have one more thing to say about this. Some of you have already reported at the beginning that when you were checking patients every 2 hours, that it was bothering them. Well, in our experience, whenever we have tried to check just every hour, it has really bothered them a lot. That's a lot of checking. Even if you don't do it at night, yeah, that's a lot of checking. So I really doubt that you can do it.
Even
if you said that you were going to do it, I think patients would react to that way. My suggestion, in the light of what the survey guidelines say and what we've taught you to do, is you explicitly say, you know, in your, you know, assessment notes or care plan, that we did a 3-day trial of every 2-hour pumps and checks, and that we did the 2-hour pumps and checks because that was acceptable to the patient. The patient tolerated that. And it allowed you to determine whether a patient needed a colonic program or not. I didn't use that exact language in the care plans that I gave you, an example care plan language, but it'd be easy to modify the language I gave you if you can include that kind of statement in there. So here's my point. Nowhere does it say that you have to do hourly checks. I really don't think that hourly checks for 3 days are either valuable or would be tolerated for a patient, so I wouldn't do it. I would expressly say you did it in a 2-hour basis, offer some justification for it. And finally, the next slide says MDS 3.0 RAI manual. There were a couple issues that have come up. I just want to emphasize again, all the way through the new MDS 3.0 RAI manual, a word about individualization. We have to tell you, surveyors are going to be super aware about this issue. So that language I gave you, about first prompting a patient and saying this is based on whether they would say the cure or not, and then talking to the patient about the results of the 3-day trial and her family or both, and getting them to agree that what it is you're going to do is an acceptable thing, and I think it's extraordinarily important for you now and in the future in terms of passing surveys. Which brings us to the issue, what happens if a resident does not respond to your prompt voice? Do you do check or change, or do you do a referral? Well, first, there have been issues in the past where some of you have thought that perhaps it's unacceptable to the surveyor to not have a person on a twirling program or a prompt avoidance program. I think some of you have thought that putting them on a check and change program would be interpreted as not maximizing Hive's functioning. However, this discussion again, if you refer to your RAI 3.0 manual and go to page H3, I'm going to read you something from here. There's an explicit statement here that says, residents who do not respond to a twirling trial and for whom other reversible or treatable causes are not found should receive supportive management, such as checking the resident for incontinence and changing his or her brief if needed and providing good skin care. So they're explicitly saying that checking and changing is an acceptable care routine for somebody who is not responsive Chipotling. You determine whether the response is Chipotling on that 3-day trial. It's a mistake if you try to say that all the patients that we did a 3-day trial on are responsive to proper boarding. There's nobody's ever published anything that said that's the truth. That 100% of people in the nursing room are responsive, and I think it would be suspicious. If you do a trial and everybody lines up on a toileting, because I think people acknowledge that there's a substantial proportion of people who not only are not responsive to proper boarding, but don't even particularly want it. And a nursing home that clearly separates those people with good documentation, I think is a nursing home who will look like they're very professional in implementing this BJHS guidelines. It does beg the question of when you do a referral, though. And I've discussed that before. We need to just touch on it again. If you have a patient who you put on a 3-day trial and they frequently try the toilet, maybe are even successful in their toileting attempts during that 3-day trial, but they continue to be wet each time you check them. This patient with a high frequency of toileting and a high frequency of wetness. And if that same patient, according to your interviews, is bothered by this, then you should do a referral, because that's the classic example of somebody with stress or urge incontinence that will not be treatable just with a toileting program alone. Something else would have to be done with those patients, and they should be referred. Who to refer them to, you might be asking. Again, that's a problem. I don't know where you live. And unfortunately, many physicians, or most physicians, are not trained in how to assess and treat urinary incontinence in elderly people. But nevertheless, the patient I just described does need a follow-up. They do need a referral. That's the type of patient who, if they had a pretty cursory urological exam, you probably could come up with supplementary treatment. And some of you have mentioned bladder drills, or biofeedback. Some of you have mentioned Dictopan or other medications. Those are the kind of things you would do with those patients. But when they take that kind of patient, if you put someone in a 3-day trial comfortably, they sell a toilet, that don't show very much motivation to do so, and still stay wet, there is really no point in referring that person. Not so much more of a workup. Obviously, that patient is showing no motivation by the time they become incontinent, and it's almost impossible to think that you could do a medical treatment which would all of a sudden reverse this. So you really just should be selective and do a follow-up for patients who seem to be really trying to do prompted boarding, trying to toilet, but just can't stay wet. But the other basic statement to leave you with is it's perfectly justifiable and consistent with the guidelines to put at least some people on check and change programs. And in fact, doing that, to me, reflects that you really have individualized this program. Having 100% of people on a clothing program, or 100% of people on a check and change program, that doesn't look like individualization. But that just looks like compliance. Because the reality is, if you do individualize it, people are going to sort themselves out. So the final thing to say to you is that I appreciate being able to talk to you for these weeks. If you want to talk to me personally about any of the issues that we've covered, or the preference interview, or improvements, how we might do some of these things, if you'll let Andy know, she'll contact me and I'll call you. We can talk about that. But I would like to thank you very much for your participation. Andy, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. I mean, is this clear? I took it off of my speaker. Okay, so I'm going to hope it's clear to everybody else and that I'm not going to cut in and out. Tell me if I do yet, because right now you're still the only one who's not muted. this has all along been a kind of a quality improvement program for nursing homes on the topic of incontinence management. We sort of practice what we preach, and it's going to be a quality improvement program for us as well. And for us to do that, I need your feedback. Your feedback to us is going to help us improve this course. We did this course almost 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and evaluated it and got feedback that caused us to change it and tweak it this time around. So we do take your feedback very seriously. We do act on it. We're trying to listen to you all along. And I know you guys are all very busy, and I don't mean to give you more work. So we have tried to design these evaluations so that they may look a little long, but they really don't take much to complete, because it's really kind of a check the box kind of thing. What I'd like to do, as you guys know, I sent to all of the project liaisons, and these are the people who typically get a coaching call from us every week. It's not everyone who's participating, so don't worry if you don't know what I'm talking about, but there is someone at every nursing home who we call every month to see how it's going. That person should report to me how many course evaluations your facility would like, and that is based on the number of staff members who have been regularly attending and participating in the teleconference. I leave it to you guys to decide. I'm not going to give you any more, I'm not going to limit it in any other way. If you've been regularly attending the teleconferences, if you'd like to get the CEs that are attached to this project, and there's 13 of them, please complete a course evaluation. I am going to send out as many course evaluations to each nursing home as your project liaison tells me you need. That's really a convenience, I hope, to you guys. You don't have to print it for us, you know. That said, I'm also going to post the course evaluation online. So you can always go there, download it, complete it, and send it back to me. And I will also email it. But again, as a convenience so that you don't have to print these out, I'm happy to send you as many as you say you need, along with the postage to return it. The evaluation is a longer form than you've gotten from us so far, so it might be inconvenient to fax it to me. It might be easier to send it to me. We will send you the return postage. Again, you know, you don't have to wait for me to do that. If you want, you can send it back on your own dime. That's fine. You can even fax it to us. That's also okay. But again, as a convenience, we'll provide that if you'd like. And I'd like we're still finalizing that form, and I'll send it out, I hope, by the end of the week or early next week, so please look for it. I will be following up if I don't hear from you again. The feedback is really important to us. It's really helpful to us, so we really want to hear from you. I'm also going to send just to the people who have been getting our coaching calls, and I believe they know who they are, one person at each nursing home who is our contact person for that nursing home, a brief supervisor's report. I think it runs like 2 pages. And these are questions that can only be answered at the facility level, so we don't want everybody answering them. So I'll send that out to you by email. And then we're also going to ask everyone to, and I think it's customary with the continuing education program, to take the post-training test. And I will have a link to this online. You can, as many of you did last time, print it and fax it back to us, whatever works for you. And that allows us to see whether, you know, you've gotten the content. And finally, most of you have already submitted resident data forms for the toileting trials you've conducted. And that form allows me to give you credit for the field assignments, which is a big part of the 13 CE hours attached to this course. If you're nursing home, if you're one of the few who hasn't, I will email you and prompt you to, you know, to try to send that back to me, assuming that you've done some of the field assignments. If you've already faxed those to me, just assume I've gotten them. A lot of you have already asked me about that, and I've reported back to you that I have gotten it. I've gotten it from almost everybody. Just a few haven't sent it back in.
I know that's a lot to throw at you, and it sounds worse than it is when I'm saying it myself. So really, we tried to limit the, we've tried to design these forms so that it will not take you very long to complete, you know. But again, the feedback's really important to us.
I want to take a minute to thank Jack for everything he's done with this course and presentations. I always learn so much from him, and I've heard it a couple of times. I think it's really timely stuff given that MDS 3.0 is coming online and you've got these new incontinence items coming out. If you notice, and some of you have remarked to me that, you know, gee, this program seems really in line with these new MDS 3.0 items, it's really no surprise because a lot of those MDS 3.0 items are based on Dr. Snowy's work and a few others. So there's a, you know, there is a direct correlation. We were lucky to have him. He is really a national expert on this topic. I want to now open up the teleconference to questions.